bigger home run in your life.
Fly ball deep left center. Grissom
on the game over. World Series.
World Series win.
Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, is a deadly disease that causes a hardening of the spinal cord. This leads to a slow and painful deterioration of muscles and nerve endings. ALS often begins with muscle weakness or slurred speech. Eventually, ALS affects control of the muscles needed to move, speak, eat, and even breathe. The cruelest part of ALS is that while it ravages the body, it leaves the mind unaffected. Patients are usually fully cognizant and coherent until the final weeks. They are condemned to witness their own slow demise. This was Lou Gehrig's fate, and he learned of it on his 36th birthday. I'm Nina Instead, and this is Deadball. Henry Louis Gehrig was born to Heinrich and Christina Gehrig, two first-generation German immigrants who lived in the Yorkville section of Manhattan. Yorkville is on the Upper East Side, and today it's among the city's most prestigious addresses. It was not a glamorous address when Lou Gehrig came along in June of 1903. Lou was a big, healthy baby, unlike his siblings, none of whom lived to adulthood. His older sister, Anna, she died in 1902 when she was just 3 months old. Another sister, Sophie, was almost two when she died of complications from measles. Lou's mother would give birth to another son, but the child did not live long enough to receive a name. Such was life in the New York City slums at the beginning of the 20th century. Perhaps because he was the only surviving child, Lou was doted on by an overly protective mother. Lou's father, Heinrich, who went by Henry, was a part-time sheet metal worker who was frequently unemployed because he sometimes drank too much and was subject to spontaneous bouts of ill health. When Henry did make it to work, it was sporadic at best, and supporting the small family fell on Lou's mother. This made her both the breadwinner and the primary parent. When Lou was 5 years old, the Gehrig family moved from Yorkville to Washington Heights. Their new apartment was within shouting distance of Hilltop Park, home to the New York Highlanders of the American League. The Highlanders would later be known as the New York Yankees. Also nearby was the grandest stadium in sports, the Polo Grounds, home to the New York Giants of the National League. The original Polo Grounds were built in 1890. And it was a location for baseball, football, and, not surprisingly, polo. According to Wikipedia, the earliest known surviving image of the field is an engraving of a baseball game between Yale University and Princeton University on Decoration Day, May 30th, 1882. Living close to these parks gave Lou an early appetite and appreciation for baseball. He began playing pickup games in his neighborhood, and soon discovered that he was better than most of the other kids. Before long, he was one of the best sandlot players in the city. As a boy, Lou was a fan of the Giants, and he attended games at the Polo Grounds whenever he could save up the money needed for a bleacher seat. Unfortunately, Lou's parents were not thrilled about their son's newfound devotion to baseball, something Christina Gehrig derisively called a schoolyard game. After all, she was a hard-working, poor, first-generation immigrant who had little opportunity for a better life. But her son could have that opportunity, and she did all that she could to create opportunities for him. Christina dreamed that one day her son would be in business, and therefore she believed that Lou should devote all of his time to his studies and not waste his time with games or hobbies. Lou did follow his mother's advice, at least for a while. He dedicated himself to his studies in elementary school, but he still found time to play baseball during the summer and on weekends throughout his childhood. By the time he was a teenager, Lou gained a reputation of being one of the best amateur baseball players in the city. In 1917, Gehrig enrolled at Commerce High School in Manhattan, where he played both baseball and football. And listeners, I'm certain that his mother was behind the decision for him to attend Commerce. The school, which opened in 1902, was meant to prepare young men for careers after high school, including pursuit of a college education. This was a very desirable school for a young man like Lou Gehrig. When Lou was in high school, his mother worked as a maid at the Sigma Nu Theta fraternity house at Columbia University. And, always a good son, Lou often went to the fraternity house to help Christina serve dinner and wash dishes afterward. He also worked part-time jobs in butcher shops and grocery stores. He needed to help supplement the household income. And despite his efforts, the Gehrig family remained very poor. While things at home were a struggle, his on-field performance was anything but. Lou Gehrig first gained national attention for his athletic prowess days after his 17th birthday, on June 26, 1920, when the city of Chicago sponsored a game between Gehrig's high school team, the New York City High School Champions, and Chicago's best team from Lane Tech High School. The game was played in Chicago in front of a crowd of more than 10,000 spectators at Cubs Park. Cubs Park is going to be renamed Wrigley Field in about 6 years. With the game on the line in the eighth inning, Lou belted over the right field bleachers for a game-winning grand slam, and with one hit, the legend of Lou Gehrig was born. In 1921, Lou enrolled at Columbia on a football scholarship. Despite his obvious baseball talent, Lou was a bruising running back in high school, and his football skills got him a full ride to Columbia. Columbia's baseball coach encouraged Lou to join the team during his sophomore year in 1923, and it wasn't long before Lou was crushing baseball records at Columbia. In a 19-game season, Lou set new school records for batting average at .444, slugging percentage at .937, and home runs. He had 7 of them. His power at the plate was the stuff of legend. Lou was also the team's top pitcher. His greatest mound performance came on April 18, 1923, the same day that Yankee Stadium opened. This was a game against Williams College. Lou struck out 17 batters. This is a school record that still stands to this day, almost 100 years later. Despite his success in sports, Lou did not like college. He received good grades and didn't mind his classes, but he was quiet and shy. On the rare occasion where he would attend a party or social event, he would often sit by himself quietly. And when it came to young women, he was especially awkward. In April of 1923, Lou caught the attention of a New York Yankee scout. The Yankees offered him a $1,500 bonus plus $400 a month. This was a small fortune to a family like the Gehrigs. An income like that, which equals about $6,000 a month in today's money, it's life-changing. While his mother expected him to get an education and work in business, there was a reality to be faced. His parents were not in good health, and taking a job playing pro ball, that would bring in more money than he could have hoped for. So, Lou accepted the Yankees' offer, and he could hardly believe his good fortune. He was done with college, he could support his parents, and he was playing the sport that he loved. This was the first time Lou ever went against his mother's wishes. The second time would come years later when he gets married, but we'll get to that in a minute. The Yankees hoped that the Columbia standout was major league ready, but after Gehrig played just 7 games in early 1923, Yankees manager Miller Huggins asked him to play out the season in the minors and shipped him off to the Hartford Senators. In Hartford, Lou Gehrig's professional baseball career took off. In only 59 games, he hit .304 with 24 home runs. When Hartford's season ended in September, the Yankees drew Gehrig back to the team, where he played 6 more games and hit .476. He had 4 doubles, a home run, and 8 RBIs. Lou was hitting so well that Miller Huggins tried to add him to the Yankees' 1923 World Series roster. The Yankees' opponent in the World Series were the New York Giants. Giants manager John McGraw protested to baseball commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis. He said Lou hadn't played enough games to be added to the roster, and Landis agreed. So Lou Gehrig sat out the 1923 World Series, and he watched the Yankees beat the Giants 4-2. Although Gehrig attended spring training with the Yankees in 1924, the team could not find him a permanent position, and management wanted him to get more seasoning in the minors. Lou was again sent to Hartford, where his stats proved he belonged in the major leagues. Playing for Hartford, Lou hit .369 with 37 home runs, 40 doubles, and 13 triples in 134 games. When Hartford's season ended, Huggins once again invited Gehrig to join the Yankees in September. Miller Huggins wanted desperately to get Lou some playing time. The problem was that the Yankees of the early 1920s were loaded with talent. Their lineup included Babe Ruth, who was changing the game with his long home runs. The Yankees also had a star first baseman named Wally Pipp. In 1924, Pipp hit .295 with 19 triples, 9 home runs, and 114 RBIs. Pipp had been the starter for almost a decade, and he was in the prime of his career at 32 years old. Once again, Lou is relegated to the Yankees bench, where he would pinch hit and fill in where he could. Lou's big break came on June 2, 1924. Miller Huggins decided to give Lou a start at first base and to give Wally Pipp a rest. Throughout the years, there's been some controversy on how Lou got into the lineup. It's widely believed that Wally Pipp had a headache and asked Huggins for the day off. It would serve as a lesson to not miss work or else you might be pipped. The word has become synonymous with being replaced. But the truth? Well, it's more complicated. Wally Pipp did get beaned in batting practice and suffer a severe concussion and headaches. But that event did not occur until July 2nd. A full month after Lou Gehrig had already replaced him. The truth is that Wally Pipp had been struggling at the plate, hitting only .244 through June. The team was also floundering in seventh place, and that's where they would finish the season. It was time to look for a silver lining, and his name was Lou Gehrig. Lou quickly proved to Huggins and his teammates that he could play every day and that he could hit big league pitching. In 126 games, Lou hit .295 with 23 doubles, 10 triples, 20 home runs, and 68 RBIs. Lou's showing was good enough to convince Huggins and the Yankees ownership that he was the first baseman of the future. And Pip, he was the first baseman of the past. So on January 15th, 1926, the Yankees sold Pip to Cincinnati for $7,500. And the veteran played the final 3 years of his career with the Cincinnati Reds. Lou Gehrig is now the Yankees' first baseman, and he's hitting fourth in the lineup behind Babe Ruth. This lineup would become known as Murderer's Row, and would soon be considered one of the greatest lineups in baseball history. Off the field, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, total opposites. Ruth was outgoing and relished the spotlight. Lou was quiet and reserved and shy. Where Ruth liked to drink and enjoy the nightlife after a game, Gehrig would return to the home he shared with his parents. It's said that Lou's adventures and outings were mostly limited to riding the roller coaster at Coney Island. Despite their different personalities, Lou and the Babe became good friends. Lou and the Babe would go fishing and hunting together in the off-season. And having experienced only a few home-cooked meals during his life, the Babe really enjoyed dinners at Ma Gehrig's. The Babe even bought Ma Gehrig a puppy to express his gratitude for her hospitality. But the friendship between the stars, it wouldn't last. You see, Babe had a daughter by his first wife, and you can hear all about the first Mrs. Babe Ruth back in episode 2, titled Helen Ruth. When Helen died, the Babe quickly remarried, and his new wife had a daughter from a previous marriage. Christina Gehrig made a comment that the Babe treated his stepdaughter better than he treated his own child. And, not surprisingly, the Babe did not like this allegation, even if there were a lot of people who would agree with her assessment. The comment, and Babe's hurt feelings, this led to a rift between himself and Lou. Despite tension between them off the field, Gehrig and Ruth provided one of the greatest 1-2 tandems in baseball history. Both men were hitting home runs at a record pace during the 1920s. And the Babe and Lou complemented each other. Where Ruth was loud and boisterous, Lou was quiet and reserved. Ruth lived in the moment, but Lou was steady and consistent. Ruth craved attention, and Lou Gehrig was shy and avoided the spotlight. Some say that Lou's greatest accomplishment was his durability. Between 1925 and 1939, Lou Gehrig would play in 2,130 consecutive games. A remarkable record that would stand for over half a century. And the Yankees lineup was impressive. In addition to Ruth and Gehrig, they had future Hall of Fame players center fielder Earl Combs, second baseman Tony Lazzari, as well as pitchers Herb Pennock and Wade Hoyt. With the lineup now set, the Yankees went from an average baseball team to winning six American League pennants and three World Series over the next 10 years. With Ruth and Gehrig in the lineup, the Yankees seemed unstoppable. During the 1920s, the Yankees would win six World Championships and three American League pennants. And the 1927 Yankees? That's still considered the greatest team of all time. Despite the World Series titles and being a celebrated athlete, Lou Gehrig was lonely. Finding someone to date was easy. Getting them to stick around? That was a little more difficult. Lou had dated several women in the past, a couple of them even pretty seriously, but the relationships seemed to fall apart when he introduced them to his mother. Christina Gehrig was overprotective of Lou. She had yet to meet a girl that was good enough for her son. Also, she wanted to maintain the strong bond that they shared, and I suspect she feared that a wife would change their relationship. Then came Eleanor. Eleanor Grace Twitchell was born on March 6, 1904 in Chicago, a world away from the streets and sandlots of Upper Manhattan where Lou, a year older, learned how to hit a baseball. Eleanor did not have a happy childhood. Her father was embroiled in an extramarital affair that severely damaged his relationship with Eleanor's mother. Despite school being a reprieve from what was going on at home, Eleanor, well, she wasn't big on school, so instead of going to university, she took a couple of courses and began working as a secretary. In 1931, Eleanor was attending a party where there were Yankees players in attendance. Although Lou did not normally attend parties, his roommate and good friend, Yankees catcher Bill Dickey, he encouraged him to go. Spotting the ballplayer sitting alone in the corner, Eleanor approached Lou and introduced herself. The two chatted, and Lou offered to walk her home. After arriving at her doorstep, Lou didn't ask to come in. Instead, he awkwardly mumbled something about the team's curfew and abruptly departed. Eleanor was confused and disappointed, but the feelings didn't last, because soon there were letters and telegrams and flowers and long-distance phone calls. At 28 years old, Lou Gehrig was in love. The feeling was mutual, and soon the two were talking marriage. But there was still one hurdle to overcome. Lou's mother. Lou suggested that Christina visit Eleanor in Chicago and get to know her. Christina agreed, but the meeting could not have been worse. After spending 2 days with Eleanor, she told Lou that Eleanor was not the woman for him, and Eleanor, when she heard this, was just heartbroken. Previously, Lou would break off relationships that his mother didn't approve of, but this time, this was different. Lou told his mother that he loved her and that would never change, but he also loved Eleanor and wanted to marry her. Lou and Eleanor were married on September 29, 1933. The couple initially lived with Lou's parents, but soon moved into their own apartment in New Rochelle, a suburb of New York City. It was here that the couple established their home and began their life together. Lou and Eleanor were more than spouses. They were best friends. She attended all of his games at Yankee Stadium, and she would often go on road trips to see him play. In the winter, the couple would ice skate, and Eleanor introduced Lou to live theater. There were movies and dinners and evenings with friends. She slowly coaxed him out of his shell. For the first time in his life, Lou enjoyed socializing and being out on the town. In the spring, Eleanor would join Lou in Florida. They would go deep-sea fishing together, swim in the ocean, and even play golf. The future looked so bright for the couple, They were young and they were in love, and they had no way of knowing that Lou was dying. In January of 1938, Lou took advantage of the off-season and starred in a Hollywood picture, Rawhide. This was the tale of baseball legend Lou Gehrig, who retires from the sport to be a rancher, only to find that bandits are making things hard for him and other ranchers. According to the Internet Movie Database, two songs from the movie were written by Albert von Tilser. If you aren't familiar with his name, von Tilser, you surely know his work. He wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And while Lou had a lot of fun in the offseason, things were decidedly more difficult on the field in 1938. He went through long droughts at the plate. He had been through slumps before, but now they lasted for weeks instead of days. Hits that once went for doubles or home runs were now soft singles. Routine ground balls that he fielded with ease hundreds of times, maybe even thousands of times, were now difficult for him to snag. Since the All-Star Game started in 1933, Lou had been named to every squad. In 1938, he was named to the All-Star team once again, but this time, he didn't deserve it. But baseball fans are a sentimental lot, so no one seemed to mind if the great Lou Gehrig was slowing down a bit. However, those who played with Lou and against him, they suspected it was more than just the natural aging of a baseball player. They sensed, and I'm certain Lou himself was aware, that something wasn't right. His play was no longer consistent. Opposing pitchers were no longer afraid of him. In fact, pitchers would walk Joe DiMaggio just so they could pitch to Lou, the man who had more RBIs than any other player in baseball history. In addition to inconsistent play, there were other signs. Lou's muscles constantly ached. His hands were sore, and he often felt dizzy or lightheaded. After the 1938 All-Star Game, Lou seemed to rebound. He hit well during the dog days of August when a lot of players begin to wilt. But in September, he slumped again. The year ended with Lou's average dipping to .295 with 170 hits, 29 home runs, and 114 RBIs. A year that most major league ballplayers would kill for. But for Lou, it was a preview of things to come. In October, the Yankees swept the Chicago Cubs in the 1938 World Series. Lou Gehrig, the most prolific hitter in World Series history, went 4-for-14, all singles. With the series completed, Eleanor insisted that Lou see a doctor. He was diagnosed with a gallbladder issue and ordered to follow a strict diet of raw fruits and vegetables. Lou was relieved by the diagnosis at first, even buoyant. Eleanor was more skeptical, but she kept it from Lou and watched him carefully. In the winter between 1938 and 1939, Lou continued to have health problems. There were unexplained muscle spasms, headaches, and his hands were always sore. Lou and Eleanor had long enjoyed ice skating in Manhattan. Lou had become good at skating. He had been skating with Eleanor for years, but now he struggled. He stumbled and he fell. People watching him skate assumed that he was a beginner. Then Lou had problems getting dressed. He struggled with his neckties and putting on shoes. He would become winded after short walks, and he was always saying that he was tired. He told his wife that he needed a long rest and that by spring training he would be himself again. Lou arrived in Florida for spring training in 1939 looking terrible. He'd lost weight and he had a sad, distant look. His Yankees teammates were shocked by his appearance. In his autobiography, Joe DiMaggio wrote that Lou seemed to age overnight. DiMaggio said that Lou swung and missed 19 straight batting practice fastballs. Pitches that Lou would have crushed earlier in his career. His teammates watched in disbelief as Lou faded before their eyes. At first base, Lou's reactions were slow. Yankees infielders began to let up on their throws to first, fearing Lou would not be able to get his glove up fast enough to protect himself. And Lou struggled during the exhibition season. He looked bad at the plate and he looked bad in the field. Lou told reporters he was always struggling in the spring, but he would be ready when the season started. But listeners, he wasn't ready. After the first week of the 1939 season, Lou had just 4 hits and 28 at-bats, a 1.43 batting average, and all of Lou's hits had been singles. On April 30th, the Yankees hosted the Washington Senators. Lou was 0 for 4. In the 8th inning, Lou flew out to center field. For Lou Gehrig, it was at-bat 8,001 of his career. It was also his last. After the Washington game, the Yankees left on a grueling 5-city, 12-game road trip out west. The stops included Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, Chicago, and Philadelphia. Yankees manager Joe McCarthy insisted to reporters he had no plans of taking Lou out of the lineup. He said he may move Lou a bit lower in the lineup, but Lou's consecutive games played streak was safe. And on May 1st, 1939, the Yankees arrived in Detroit to kick off the road trip against the Tigers. On the morning of May 2nd, Lou was reading a newspaper in the hotel lobby when Joe McCarthy walked up to the front desk to check his messages. Lou asked if he could speak to the manager in private. The two men returned to McCarthy's room, where Lou told McCarthy he was taking himself out of the lineup. McCarthy said, "Lou, are you sure?" And Lou nodded. And just like that, Lou Gehrig's streak of playing 2,130 consecutive games, a record that would stand for the next 56 years, came to an unceremonious end. While Lou would stay with the team for the remainder of the 1939 season, his playing days were over. And Lou would report to the park every day just like before. He would help warm up his teammates by playing catch and cheer for the team from the bench. In early June, Lou flew to Rochester, Minnesota to meet with doctors at the Mayo Clinic. Lou intended to be at the clinic for a week, hoping to find answers. And the experts at the Mayo Clinic, they probably didn't need a full week to find a diagnosis, but they knew who they were treating and how many people were waiting to hear what they had to say. On June 19th, Lou Gehrig's 36th birthday, the doctors provided him with a diagnosis. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It was Lou Gehrig's death sentence. And it's possible the doctors sugarcoated the diagnosis. They told him about the incredible research that was being done on ALS, which I'm sure gave him some hope. But his baseball career was over. Even Lou knew that. He returned to New York to talk to Joe McCarthy and Yankee president Ed Barrow. Lou provided them with a letter from his doctors. The two men read the letter in silence, and Barrow could only mutter softly, "I'm so sorry, Lou." The Yankees offered to hold a special day to honor Lou Gehrig. The day would be July 4th, 1939, and the ceremony would be held in between games of a doubleheader with the Washington Senators. Baseball fans across the country were shocked and saddened to learn the news about Lou, and that this vibrant young athlete would play no more. Tuesday, July 4th was a hot summer day in New York City, but 61,808 fans packed the bunting-draped ballpark to say thank you to the Yankees' great iron horse. Eleanor, along with her mother and Lou's parents, sat together behind home plate. Onlookers would never have known there was tension between Eleanor Gehrig and her mother-in-law. The two were focused solely on Lou and on this bittersweet day. The Yankees lost the opening game to the Senators 3-2, but no one in the stadium seemed to care. They were there not just to watch another baseball game, but to honor Lou Gehrig. Once the first game was complete, the ceremony began. For over 40 minutes, Lou was heralded by members of the 1927 Yankees, including the leader of Murderers Row, teammate Babe Ruth, who smiled and hugged Lou. Their rift appeared to be forgotten. Then there were speeches by New York City Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia and Postmaster General James A. Farley. Lou was overwhelmed. At first, Lou waved off an opportunity to address the crowd. But after being encouraged by Joe McCarthy, Lou stepped up to the bank of microphones and delivered one of the most iconic speeches ever. Lou remained with the Yankees for the remainder of the season. And the Yankees would go on to win yet another World Series title, this time defeating the Cincinnati Reds in the Fall Classic 4-0. Lou was there on the bench rooting for his teammates, but the torch was passed, and this was Joe DiMaggio's team now. After the series, Lou cleaned out his Yankee locker for the very last time. The Yankees could have given Lou a coaching job, or perhaps a position in the front office. They could have, but they didn't. Lou was on his own. He finally accepted a job offer from Mayor LaGuardia, a civil servant position serving essentially as a parole officer. The job paid an annual salary of $5,700, a far cry from what he was used to earning with the Yankees, but it was steady employment and Lou felt useful. And feeling useful was very important to him. The new job's responsibilities included interviewing prisoners and determining which ones merited a second chance. Many of the prisoners that Lou interviewed would tell him about their bad breaks. In addition to working, he spent the next 2 years spending time with his wife, Eleanor. When Lou was having a good day, they would go out to dinner or go see a movie. They both also enjoyed the theater, but there were fewer options for the couple, because the things they loved, like golf, ice skating, or long walks, they were no longer an option. Lou could not do any activity that was physically taxing. When Lou could no longer drive, Eleanor would take him to the office. There she would open his mail and type his letters. Baseball had not forgotten about Lou Gehrig, and they honored him by inducting him to the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 1939. At 10:10 p.m. on Monday, June 2, 1941, Lou Gehrig lost his fight with ALS. He was 37 years old. Upon hearing the news, Babe Ruth and his wife Claire went to the Gehrig house to console Eleanor. Mayor LaGuardia ordered flags in New York to be flown at half-staff, and major league ballparks around the country did likewise. Thousands viewed Gehrig's body at the Church of the Divine Paternity. Babe Ruth cut in line ahead of everyone and wept openly in front of the casket. Following the funeral across the street from his house at Christ Episcopal Church of Riverdale, Gehrig's remains were cremated on June 4th at Kensico Cemetery in Valhalla, New York. Eleanor Gehrig, she never remarried, and she died 43 years after Lou, on her 80th birthday, March 6, 1984. She was buried beside her husband. The Yankees dedicated a monument to Gehrig in center field at Yankee Stadium on July 6, 1941. And on September 6, 1995, a standing-room-only crowd, a crowd that included President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, they packed into Baltimore's Camden Yards. Millions more watched around the world as Baltimore shortstop Cal Ripken Jr. played in his 2,131st consecutive game, surpassing Lou Gehrig's record that has stood for 56 years. In a speech after the fifth inning, Cal Ripken Jr. stood in front of a bank of microphones and said, quote, "Tonight I stand here, overwhelmed, as my name is linked with the great and courageous Lou Gehrig. I am truly humbled to have our names spoken in the same breath." The Dead Ball Podcast is created by Tim Scott. This week's episode was written by Nina Instead and Tim Scott. Chuck Walters is our technical consultant and audio editor. If you're enjoying the podcast, take a moment to leave a rating or a review on your favorite podcatcher. It helps other baseball lovers find the show and the stories shared here. To learn more or to talk with like-minded baseball fans, join the Dead Ball discussion group on Facebook.
For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad break. Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. When you look around, wouldn't you consider it a privilege to associate yourself with such a fine-looking man as is standing in uniform in this ballpark today? But I might have been given a chance.